This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker. Hello there. I'm Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. Always a pleasure to have you here. And boy, have we got a show for you today. The man NPR calls an icon with a huge voice. He is known the world over. Hey, I'm just reading it here.
Yeah, you're reading it.
He's known the world over for wringing every ounce of soul out of every song he sings. He's been nominated 3 times for the Blues Music Award for Song of the Year, winning the prize in 2018 for Walk a Mile in My Blues. All told, he's won 11 Blues Music Awards, including the B.B. King Entertainer of the Year Award. Now, I could go on. He's probably going to correct me, but let's hear it from the man himself. Curtis Salgado, welcome to Time Signatures. How are you?
I'm honored to be here, and I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And this sounds extremely pretentious, but I guess that's what it is, you know, is... And I'll talk about awards here right after I say this. I have 14 awards.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the information on the page I was reading is wrong.
Yeah. It was written years ago, long time ago.
Just so you know, I try to do my homework when I do interviews like this, just so you're aware.
No worries.
We got a ton of stuff to talk about here. So let's dive right in.
All right.
Talk about your earliest memories of music, Curtis.
I got a lot of them, and I've said this little story. I've been interviewed with the same question, and kindergarten is where, and the kindergarten teacher pinned a note on my shirt, and she said, "Make sure your mother gets this," and she pinned it on. And so when I got home, my mother said, "What's this?" And she read it. And she goes, "Oh, well, the teacher says you have a nice voice and you should learn these songs. Jesus Loves Me, Yes, I Know. And I've Been Working on the Railroad." And we almost went to work immediately. My mother was a good piano player. She could play stride. She could read. My father was an aspiring opera singer. He wanted to do opera, and he was actually taking lessons with a notable teacher in the Northwest and stuff. But you got to remember, this is before World War II.
Okay.
And, you know, I would find, you don't have to remember it. I should remind you or say that if this is before the war broke out. And that said, she read the note, and we got to work on "I've Been Working on the Railroad" and "Jesus Loves Me, Yes, I Know." And, I didn't really know what it was about, you know. And then when I went to kindergarten, went to school, I'll say, you did what you were told to do. And the next thing I know, I'm on stage and I'm rehearsing with other kids. But I didn't have any concept that this was rehearsing or this is. You follow the teacher in, she told you what to do, sing the song. So the next thing I know, moving very quickly, is that it's in the auditorium of the church and kindergarten that I went to, and it's full of parents, and we're all up standing up on stage, you know, doing what we're to do. But I'm not putting the concept together at all. I just know, get up there and sing. So I went up on stage. And they paired me up with another boy. And he was standing to my left. He was taller than I was. And he got stage fright. And he just froze. And I'm just looking at him going, "I've been working on the railroad all the live long day, like, ah, come on, you know, let's go, you know. And he just stood there with his eyes as big as saucers. I can still see it in my head. And then Jesus loves me. Yes, I know, like this, you know, he's not going on. The audience thought it was adorable and was laughing and applauding, and I got a standing ovation. He didn't get the standing ovation because he didn't do anything. He was just frozen stiff. And I didn't know it was, you know, like when we walked off stage, you know, he kind of ran off and stuff. And I had no idea what was happening. I didn't really get the concept of like, you're going to go to the assembly, the parents are going to be there, and here's what we've accomplished with your kids. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, I was hooked. And then from that point on, I was told I had a nice voice. I didn't really sink in, and I would be the singer for the Christmas programs.
Okay.
So, you know, and in high school, I was in glee club. And I remember before high school, we were with a guy named Jester Harrison. This is a fine gospel songwriter, choir director, who was from the Black community. And he's the one who wrote, Amen, Amen, Amen. You know, he did the...
Yeah.
Yeah, he did, what's the name of Sidney Poitier in the movie, like Lily in the Valley or something like that. And Jester Harrison was that. So check this out. He came to Portland, Oregon. I was living in Eugene. That's where I was raised, Eugene, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to come up to Portland and be in the auditorium. I'm going to back up on this. It was possibly Matt Court in Eugene. But nonetheless, Jester Harrison had all the high schools. And I think it was in Portland because they were from all over. This guy was a huge choir director, and he was about to direct all the high schools.
Wow.
And I was singing lead in a song called Oh, the Angels Roll the Stone Away, which is, Oh, the angels roll the stone away. 'Twas mm-hmm. on that Easter Sunday morning, you know. And I'll never forget that. It was like every high school, all of us, it was a huge, you know, probably sounded like a jacuzzi, but he was in the middle. So that's a standby thing with me. And then from that to Glee Club, and then from that to, I wasn't old enough to be in bars yet, but when the bands came to play at the high school hops, I was up on stage playing harmonica. And one of the leading bands that stood out in Eugene, Oregon, was a band called The Genetics. And nobody knows them. It's just a high school band. But they were doing, you know, Cinnamon Girl by Neil Young. And
oh, wow.
All the hits that were, you know. And then they play blues, you know, something bluesy. And I'd try and play harmonica. And so I just gave you a big shot of my life right there. That's how.
Yeah.
All this got going. There's one other thing I got to point out is
sure.
I had a guitar player. He was I took up guitar, and his name was Gary Beck, and he was the jazz player in Eugene. I'm older now. I'm still in high school, but I took guitar lessons, and he didn't have any patience, and he'd kick you. He kicked me in the shin. And go, no, look at what I'm doing here. Look. And he'd kick me. So I went home and said, man, this guy has no, it's like kicking me if I get it wrong. And my mother took that in and stuff. A couple of weeks later, my mother, I get home from school and she goes, Curtis, I have something for you. And she brought me How to Play Blues Harmonica, How to Play Blues Harmonica by Tony Little Son Glover. You ever heard of Tony Little Son Glover?
The name's familiar to me, yes.
Yeah. Well, he and a couple of other guys, they had their blues monikers, you know, names, Tony Little Son, and there was Dave Snaker Ray, and I can't remember who the third guy was, but this is the folk era, and it was about 1962, 63, and he was with these trio of guys out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Bob Dylan come. It was this Dave Von Ronk, all these guys are coming out of. Now, I'm not aware of this. My mother just brought me home this book, How to Play Blues Harmonica. But it would be by a folk artist out of Milwaukee area who had for years, and I don't mean 10 years, I mean four decades, the only blues harmonica book out
there.
And until others fell in. But he, How to Play Blues Harmonica, and she gave me a C harmonica. Now, my brother and sister, I have, they play a big part in my influence as well, and my mother and father. So I'll start there. My mother and father were jazz enthusiasts, and my folks were lovely, really, really cool. And we were, like I said, the nuclear family. We weren't exactly, we were just self-contained. We had, mm-hmm. you know, not a lot of friends and this. The friends that were at the house were usually my older brother's friends and his friends. And we kind of took them all in. And to get back online here is my folks were into Count Basie, Earl Father Hines, Anita O'Day, Gene Krupa, Earl Father Hines, as I said, this Errol Gardner, Bix Beiderbecke, Louis Armstrong, Henry Red Allen, great New Orleans trumpet player. So the 78s were there. The records were there. And then my brother and sister would bring home, you know, the Beatles, Paul Butterfield, Robert Johnson's, you know, the one where it's a drawing, Columbia Records re-released all of his 78s on the Robert Johnson, which freaked everybody yep. out. Yeah. And, you know, the folk era came and we'd watch Hootenanny on television and then the British invasion and that stuff and Shindig came and Motown. And that's the only thing that moved me, really. It wasn't like, you know, I got to do my chores, school.
Right.
You know, what I was into was music. So to this day, I can't spell very well, but I can read. You know?
So safe to say that your life was determined to be in music from the age of five, pretty much. Is that what you're
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I kind of stumbled into it. Oh, you've got a nice voice. And when that crowd stood up and stuff, it's like, hey, what? I mean, that's a lot of validation.
Sure.
But, you know.
So, Curtis, how old were you when you formed your first band?
I joined and auditioned for a band in Eugene, Oregon. I was 18 out of high school.
Okay.
But by that point, you remember, I'm going and playing with the Genetics.
Right.
And I even got a cardboard guitar. And my mother helped me make my father, by the way, is very cool and stuff. But my mom's really, she's really, you know, pushing. And she made me a cardboard guitar made out of a Stratocaster that was in an Esquire magazine, you know. And Esquire wasn't a Playboy. It was like the coolest things in stereo, great articles right. and stuff, right? And there was a fold-out of a Stratocaster saying, this is the American guitar right here. This is the one. She made a copy of it. What's my point? I was in sixth grade. I was pantomiming to records with my cardboard Strat. And then, you know, it's just, I can bounce around here a lot. But yes, let me put it this way. The thread that puts it together, the energy cable that holds us all together in the Salgado family was music. It's the one thing that besides being a knucklehead or you got to dump the garbage or rake the leaves or this and that, it was music. So I'll give you I was in Cub Scouts and then I was in Boy Scouts and I did a 50-mile hike for the Skyline Trail when I was in Boy Scouts. So I'm out there in the woods for a couple of weeks. And when I came home from this and accomplishing a 50-mile hike out there with, you know, six or seven other guys, and I came home and my father picked me up. where we were, you know, had congregated to get our parents come and get us. And I go home and shower and I come and sit down at the table. And I go, okay, so what's new? And my parents said, this will give you an idea. They go, well, what's up is like Ray Charles has got a new hit on the radio. Oh, really? What's that? And, let's go get stoned. And let's go, you know. And I was really, and can you guys have it? Did you get, and it's like, it'll be on the radio because they're playing it constantly. And so what else? Well, there's this new band everybody's raving up about, and it's a crazy song, and it's called Wild Thing by the Trogs.
The Trogs, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, if that gives you an idea, that's what we talked about, was music, entertainment, the arts. I grew up into that. And my story isn't any more different than, it's different, but it's the same egg scrambled differently. It's the same mm-hmm. as Huey Lewis or some of this and that. You know, I grew up in I was lucky and had a loving, hip family that was into the arts. They're definitely into black music, but I didn't know any better. They didn't say anything. This is Count Basie. This is Anita O'Day. This is, you know, I was really huge on Anita O'Day, who's a great jazz singer, and Count Basie and Jimmy Rushing and Joe Williams, who sang with Count Basie. My dad had all that stuff. Yeah. So that wow. was it. I want to do that. I got to add this. I'm with my father at a Count Basie concert at MacArthur Court. And I'm 13, 14 years old. And there is Count Basie and his orchestra. All from the black community. And I mean, this is the real deal. This is the Count Basie orchestra. He still had Freddie Green on guitar. And the drummer was Speedy Rufus Jones. And Eddie Lockjaw Davis was there. And he still had Walter Page on bass. So Count Basie and Freddie Green on guitar, whatever. And Frank Foster on tenor sax, Eddie Lockjaw on tenor sax. And out came a very young Leon Thomas, who was a jazz singer, kind of ahead of the step. He was one of the first guys, really, who was one of recording his stuff with African instruments and leaning. He yodeled. He could scat and yodel. Have you ever heard of this guy?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, Leon Thomas, man. And killer singer. He was the singer for Count Basie. And I'll never forget it. And I'm listening. My father's sitting next to me. We're up in the bleachers, you know, watching the Count Basie Orchestra. And I turned to my father and said, I want to do this. I want to be in this. My father looked at me and laughed. And he goes, son, this is music made by men. I just kind of turned around. Okay, but it was just like, this is really on the road. These guys, you know, you put it together. This is like a 17-piece, all-black orchestra swinging it hard and crushing it. And, I mean, I'm just like, man, you know, audience is going, you know, crazy. And Eugene, Oregon. I was like, Count Basie, I want to be that. Well, that's just, you need to wait a while. But it was the only thing that, you know, I hope if you read in between the lines, I hope that gives you an idea of.
Oh, absolutely. What, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, so I'm hooked and I've been hooked ever since.
So you're hooked, you're getting things, you're growing up a little bit, and then you start working with the Nighthawks. How did that get started out there in Eugene?
Well, you know, like any band, you know, like I said, I was in high school and playing, and then I auditioned for a band called Three Finger Jack. And that spilled into some people come and go and fluctuate. And that turned into a couple of guys who came from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And their name were Ken Arnaldi and Harold Pursing. And Arnaldi played tenor saxophone, you'll see. And Harold was this killer bass player, man. Intellectual. They're going to the University of Oregon. That's why they're there. And we found each other somehow. Harold was already playing with the the biggest name in jazz that Oregon had, you know, supported, and his name was Sonny King. He was a tenor saxophone player of high skills, and his wife was Nancy King. And have you ever heard of Nancy King? And she's one of the best jazz singers that America has produced, and that's
wow.
That's true. And she lives here in Portland, and she was living in Eugene. And anyhow, Harold was playing with Sonny King and Nancy King. He was that good of a bass player, but he was also in a blues band by a harmonica player called Short Stuff, and the lead guy was this guy named Jimmy Lehman, who was an amazing harmonica player, songwriter, singer. And I'm 17, and I'm getting turned on to these guys, and these guys, you know, I got to know Sonny King. No, I did not, a little bit. But Nancy King, I took voice lessons from her, which consisted of her giving me a couple of records of Hendrix, Lambert, and Ross. And so, I mean, jazz and blues and soul, the dominoes fall, and I just took the path. And my story isn't unique. It's like practically everybody I know has the same story, you know, my age.
But it's a cool story nonetheless.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm not answering your question. And the answer is that turned into Harold, and we called ourselves Harold and the Nighthawks.
Okay.
So Three Finger Jack kind of dissolved, and I bit my teeth with you. I mean, I what do you call it? I made my bones with that band.
Okay.
Because we would play a bar 6 nights a week called the Roman Forum. And it was a tough bar. The only thing that was missing was the wire to protect us.
Chicken wire, yeah.
Yeah, it was a chicken. I mean, this was college kids, blue collar workers, and bikers. And there, you know, a lot of fun, a lot of, you know, growing up and stuff, a lot of fights, a lot of this, you know, it was. And then that band sort of morphed into, with Harold and the Nighthawks. Then Harold turned communist, and he was really into the drive of, at that time, the Vietnam War is going and stuff. And Harold was an intellectual, and, you know, everybody's got, you know, communism in its raw form is like an idea, you know, an idea, of course, that, you know, we as a species can't really follow truthfully like anything. But anyway, moving on. Harold turned communist. So I'd go to a gig and there would be pamphlets and protest pamphlets against, you know, Nixon or Carter or whatever on all the tables in the bar. And then he just took off. So we turned into the Nighthawks. And the Nighthawks consisted of the nephew of Ken Kesey, Rich Kesey, and Jim Cochran, who was half Cherokee and half whatever he was, Irish or something. I just made that up. The drummer was David Olson. And the other guitar player was Frank Speaker, who would play with Sonny King and Nancy King. And he had discovered the blues. This guy could, both Jim Cochran and him could play. They could play and were unique. Excuse me. And we became the Nighthawks. And it was in this time that, about 1975, we made an EP. And also around that same time, a couple of guys moved down from Tacoma. And they were, I will say, army brats, basically. Their folks were, their father was in the army. And one of them's father was a high-ranking officer. But Fort Lewis is located. Where are you stationed at? Where are you?
I'm located near Lansing, Michigan.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, here in Oregon, up I-5 near Seattle is Fort Lewis.
Okay.
And the two guys I'm talking about is Robert Cray and Richard Cousins. And they moved down. Robert's family, his father was military. high-ranking officer, military, and can you imagine that, being in the black community and getting to be a high, that's hard to do.
Yeah.
And Richard's, his mother was married to a jazz musician, and Richard and I hit it off, and Robert and I hit it off, and the three of us, I was in the Nighthawks. Robert moved down to Eugene with Richard, and they already had a band together up from Tacoma. And Robert had a good harmonica player named Rocky Mazanaris, who was kind of Paul Butterfield, and he could play. And wow. Also he had a drummer named Tom Murphy, and he had a foot. He was funky. So Robert had his band, and I was in the Nighthawks, and Robert and Richard and myself hooked up. And then the rest of the band kind of fell in. You know, Robert, I'll brag a little bit of him. Robert was completely realized. I'm 19 and he's completely realized, saying just as good then as he does now. Wow. And his guitar playing, you couldn't really, you know, it was, oh man, this guy's a straight BB. Oh man, this guy sounds just like, you know, it wasn't like he had his own sound, but you couldn't pinpoint it. He had everybody's sound and he never missed. So he just played. And, you know, now I don't think there's anybody like him. You don't know which angle he's going to turn. He does these great swallow, right?
Right,
he plays
right.
guitar. He plays incredibly rhythm patterns that are completely against, you know, the time singer. Like, you know, let's get on. I'm going to give you guys, if you notice, Albert, BB, Freddie, they sing and then play lead. Santana, not much of a chord player, great lead guitar player, but you know, they're not like rhythm guitar player. Robert's all that. And he's a great rhythm player and a great lead player and totally has his own sound. And he did when I met him at the age of 18, 19. It's just like,
amazing.
He's one of a kind. Very shy, very, you know, he's not, you know, he's just very reserved and shy. But, you know, I'm telling you, guitar players out there, it's nobody like them, you know.
And well, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, it was great. I was in a spot and the band where the Nighthawks dissolved and I ended up going with Robert Cray and Richard. All of these have stories behind them, but I'm just giving you the bare facts, you know.
No, I love it. Give me some good stuff.
I was lucky to be there with both of those guys, you know. Richard and I lived together. He is funny. I've got a good sense of humor, and he, you know, we just like what Robert, like I said. But I was in the playing with Robert when I was still in the Nighthawks. We'd take off and go play with Albert Collins. Wow. The Nighthawks didn't really want a career. I did. So I ended up going with Richard and Robert.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, I have to hear the story of your meeting with John Belushi back in 77 while he was shooting Animal House.
I knew it was coming.
How did that? Well, you know it's coming.
Yeah.
How did this unfold? And talk about the influence that meeting had on the subsequent cult favorite, the Blues Brothers.
Well, you already know what the meaning, what it turned into. I'm just as surprised as you. I didn't know it was going to do that. I didn't know who the guy was. I look at it, I tell people that, how can you not know John Belushi? Because I'm a musician. And what is the top paying night for any musician? What's the
Saturday.
Big Saturday? What'd you say?
Yeah, Saturday what? Night.
Saturday night. And what's the name of the show he's on?
Saturday Night Live.
Thank you right there.
Yep.
We didn't even own a TV. I didn't know who he was, but I tell you what happened. So there's a movie being made in Eugene I knew nothing about until Richard comes up to me one morning in our apartment and goes, hey, I auditioned for this band. There's a movie being made. I auditioned. I didn't get the part. Robert did. He didn't say the name. He goes, you know, I guess I wasn't black enough. You know, that's what Richard said. He goes, you know, what's a guy supposed to do? You know, don't, you know, put the word, another word other than guy, but what am I supposed to, you know, and he's definitely from the black community. Richard is 100% you know, soul, you know, and an amazing bass player. Anyhow, I go, really? And they go, yeah, they want to use our equipment, though. You willing to give up your amp for to be in a movie? I said, sure. And so Robert is playing, zooming ahead to the movie, and there's a lot in between, but I'm going ahead. If you look at Animal House, Robert's playing Richard's bass, and in the background is my amplifier. So, you know, there's there I am in a movie. Well, kind of me, but maybe my amp from my... So Richard's standing there in front of me going, yeah, man, they're making a movie, blah, blah. They want to use our equipment. Robert got a part in the movie. That's it. End of story. Now, we're musicians, and I'll make try and make it fast.
No, you're good. You're good.
Yeah, yeah. So you hustle gigs. I got to pay rent. We got to, you know, we got to buy. You got to take a girl out. You got to date. You got to get, you know, all the things that you do besides rent and food and tooth and teeth and, you know, food and toothpaste and stuff, I was going to say. So you're hustling gigs, and that's what musicians do. Is mm-hmm. And that's why you see an influx of different and bands, you know, musical chairs. It changes and it goes. You're trying to get a job, trying to get some gigs. You're trying to find a residential gig. You know, God, if I could only play that gig from Friday to Saturday, or from Monday to, you know, that's what you do. You hustle up gigs. Okay, so I made that point clear. So this is what happened. We go, you know what we should do? Let's get both bands together. The Nighthawks and Robert Cray. And we're already playing at this place in Eugene called the Eugene Hotel, oddly enough. And we're playing in their lounge called the King Cole Room. So we already got a Monday night there. Every Monday we play there. And I'm going to add more to it. So the Richard called us, why don't we call ourselves the Crayhawks? Okay, we're the Crayhawks. And so the Crayhawks consisted of David Olson on drums, Robert Cray on guitar, Richard Cousins on bass, and me. And then we would hire the other two guys from both bands. Like the keyboard player for Robert Cray back in those days was a guy named Dover Weinberg, who's playing with Robert today. You know, he's been, you know, Robert rehired him like a decade ago. And then the drummers were our drummer, David, was David Olson, but we also hired Tom Murphy, who I mentioned already, who was fun.
Mm-hmm.
So that everybody got a piece of the pie. So one week it'd be Tom Murphy on drums. The next week it would be, you know, David Olson. One day we'd have a keyboard player, or we'd use the Nighthawk keyboard player, DK Stewart, right? We just called him DK. So we're switching off keys and drums, and Robert and Richard and myself are the focus here. We're the singers and whatever, and everybody's happy. Everybody's getting a piece of whatever the Eugene Hotel is paying us. You following that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so it's complicated. So we got this Monday night gig, and we also develop another gig in the Eugene Hotel ballroom. And we're going to do both bands, Robert Cray, Nighthawks. So Robert's going to open up on Friday night, and he's going to close on Saturday night. You know, so I'm closing on Friday night, and I'm opening on Saturday night. So we get that one. And then what we did, and this is not needed to be said, but what it was is... we'd play, Robert play, and then both bands get together and we do songs that, you know, neither band performs. It's Your Thing, you know, Boogaloo Down Broadway by the fantastic Johnny C. Donna, you know, we're just picking out Joe Tex tunes, that kind of stuff. Okay, so it's Saturday night and I'm the opening act. Robert comes after me, and Robert's doing the movie. So that's why I'm opening up that night. It didn't really matter, but he happened to be on the studio set. I don't know. Okay. I don't even know anything about this. I'd find this out later on, like much later on. So, but Robert's at the movie set, and I don't know anything about, I know he's working on the set, but this is what happened. It's getting in the middle of my show, and a guy comes up to me and goes, "Hey, Belushi wants to meet you." And I'm in the middle of a song. So the band's kicking away and I'm singing, and this guy goes, "Carnes, come here." "Yeah, excuse me, everybody. I want to go talk to this guy." And this guy was, his name was Richard too. And he was the local cocaine dealer.
Oh, and man.
He worked with Mr. Big, who deals it out. So we all knew everybody. It's Eugene, Oregon. So he comes up to me and goes, Curtis. And I lean my head down and go, "What?" He goes, "Belushi wants to meet you." Now think of that if you don't know what a Belushi is. Belushi wants to. And I'm going, "What? What the F?" You know? And I ignore him. He does it again. I ignore him. He does it again. And I flatly tell him, "Can you cuss on this station?"
Whatever. "No, you want to say, man."
Really? Is it because, you know, I said, "F off, you know, go away." And he walks off. And then I'm going to get off stage at the end of the set because I want to go visit these three women over there that are my friends. And I love all three of them. And it's Sylvia Jennings, and it's Debbie Buck and Debbie Simpson. And they're in a, you know, and I jump off stage and I'm heading towards them, you know, my radar, I'm headed towards them. And this guy grabs me, Richard, spins me around and goes, "Belushi." I'm like, "Ta-da." And I look, and there's a guy that's about 5'6". He's shorter than me. He's stocky. Okay. And he comes up and he shakes my hand and he goes, "Hey, I like your music, man. I like what you're doing. And you know, I have a friend of mine and he plays harmonica too. His name is Dan Aykroyd." And I'm like this.
Because you don't know who these guys are.
No. I'm just like, and all I'm thinking, I don't care. Every hippie in Eugene plays harmonica. That's what I'm thinking. Who gives a shit? And I go, "Oh, okay." And there's Debbie, you know, and I'm going like, yeah, I'm kind of like, "Okay, cool." And he goes, "No, man, I'm here with a movie that's in town." And the first thing out of my mouth to the guy who was the headliner is, "Oh yeah, Robert Cray's in that movie." And he goes, he doesn't blink. He just goes, "Yeah, I saw him today. He taught us how to dance." And I knew exactly what he was talking about. But I don't know who he is. I don't care who he is. But things will change in the next 5 minutes. We talk a little bit. There's other members in that from Portland and from Eugene in the band sequence of that movie. Robert Cray's playing. The only actor is the guy who's playing Otis Day. And I can't remember his name. He's the only legitimate actor. All the rest are real deal musicians.
Wow.
And it's Robert Bailey's playing the keyboard, and you see him smile. On this guy was a genius. I'm telling you, he went on to become a gospel star, and on the 700 Club and other religious or spiritual stations. Uh-huh. He was from the Black community, of course, and he sang like a bird and played piano. This guy was brilliant. His name is Robert Bailey. You could look him up. Anyway, then the drummer is Ronnie Steen, who still plays in Portland here in town, and he's a great jazz drummer. I've done many a gig with him, and he does, you know, he plays with people that come through and this and that, and he's still working as a drummer. And then Sonny King is playing the saxophone. I'm going to drop another bomb on you there. Sonny King was written up in by Cannonball Adderley in Downbeat magazine, the famous jazz man. And Cannonball Adderley was singing his praises, like, "This guy's one of the," and Sonny King was amazing. He was, so we had a strong jazz scene going on here in Portland, and especially down there in Eugene. You had Nancy King and Sonny King and There's a few other names that escape me, but it was blues and jazz and soul. That's what it was. I could go on to some history of it. Anyway, I won't. Moving on. The other member of the band was a guy named Tommy Smith. Tom Smith, okay. Who was really into, that's the guy playing guitar. Well, he was a folk guitarist, a black community, but totally into folk music, into Bob Dylan, into, you know, all that stuff. It was kind of funny. I mean, he was, you'd think, you know, black, no, this guy was, you know, a black Pete Seeger. He was talented, played, that's what he played, folk music. And so you got Tommy Smith on guitar, Robert Cray on bass, Ronnie Steen on drums. The piano was Robert Bailey, and the drummer is, and the piano was Robert Bailey. And then the singer was, I can't remember his name, but that was Otis Day. All the rest of the guys are musicians from either Portland or Eugene that they put together. I think that's that in itself. I think somebody made a documentary about this whole thing. Moving on. So I meet John Belushi. And Belushi and I, during this meeting, I kind of went to the south. Let's go back. So I go, yeah, I remember. I know who. Yeah, yeah. He says he taught us how to dance. Okay, yeah. And then we started talking some more, John and I. And just a little bit. Remember, Sylvia Jennings is standing over there. And I still want to go over until John dropped this bomb. He goes, you know, I do kind of a variety show back in New York City. Man, it's really tough because I have to fly from New York to Portland and then take a car from Portland down here to Eugene to film the movie. And I'm listening to him. I'm getting bored. I don't know where he's going, and he's going, but I'm really excited because, I go back tomorrow night, Sunday, and on Monday, we're going to start rehearsing with Ray Charles. I said, what? You know, yeah, on the variety. He never said on Saturday Night Live, never to me, never dropped that name, you know, and because I could go on with this for 3 hours. So I'll do some pinpoints. So he goes, yeah, you know, I got to drive, whatever. And but man, we're going to do a show and do rehearsal with Ray Charles. I go, what? And he goes, yeah. And then he started walking away. And I go, whoa, come here. Whoa, what'd you say? Yeah, Ray Charles, we're going to do this thing. He's on this variety show I'm talking about and whatever that I've been saying. And I go, you got to ask him about Guitar Slim. He goes, what? Guitar Slim. I mean, Ray Charles played with Guitar. You don't know who Guitar, I'm an idiot, right? You don't know who Guitar Slim is? And he goes, no, never heard of it. Are you kidding me? And just like I'm doing to all you and the folks listening and watching, I just take off. Guitar Slim, you know, Ray Charles is playing on the things I used to do. It was a hit record, stayed on charts for probably, 1953 forever. Charles arranged the horns, of course, and he's playing piano. But I'm going, did you know Ray Charles plays alto saxophone? You got to ask him about that. You got to ask him. He goes, he plays saxophone? I go, yeah, man, it's on Hot Rod, 1958. Atlantic Records, live in Newport Jazz, the genius, and it's Ray Charles plays on a song called Hot Rod, alto saxophone. And he looks at me and goes, let's go smoke a joint. And I go, okay. So we go up and we take a little, you know, smoke a little bit and stuff. And that's must have been where I exchanged phone numbers or not. I don't think I did, because remember, it's a three. This is why I'm telling you this stuff. It's a three thing. I got to go back on and do when both bands get together. And I was late. I remember that. Oh, and, you know, just a little bit. But yeah. I had to run and do that. And I didn't see Belushi for the rest of the night. And then about 4 days later, living with Richard, the phone rings, the good old phones. I pick it up and it's Belushi, John Belushi. Hi, this is John Belushi. And I said, how'd you get this phone number? And he goes, I have my ways. Well, thinking about it, you know, it wouldn't have been hard to get our phone number, but he called me up and said, come on over to the house. Judy Jacklin, she's cooking dinner. My wife is cooking dinner. Why don't you come over and join us, man, and bring your records. I'd like to talk with you and stuff. And I said, okay. And it turns out the house he's in is, these are houses that if you're in a movie, they can ask the people who live in the house if it works right, or just setting him up, right? So these people went on vacation, and the movie company, which would be Universal's, pay for whatever damage done or this or that, you know? And he's with his wife and stuff. And so they put him not in a hotel, but in a house in Eugene.
Wow.
So I drove over to this house, and somebody sent me a picture of it, a little side note here, just like a month ago. Anyway, I went over to the house. Judy is behind the, she's, you know, it's got an island counter, and then the kitchen and a dining room table, and it's a big house and stuff. And he goes, yeah, come on in. And I brought over a pile of records, which consisted of, one of them is, here's one right here. I brought this one over. And this is New Orleans piano, Professor Long here. I brought over a bunch of stuff. And what happened was I had dinner with him, and I just started running down, you know, who, just like, look, what I'm doing to you folks and torturing you, this is what I did to Bellucci. You got to hear this. Did you know this? Did you know? Let me, you ever heard of this guy? You ever heard of that? You know, so he got the little Walter Sonnyboy Williamson, Lowell Fulson, what's his name? King Floyd, all of this stuff. And we were doing, I brought him Sam and Dave. I brought him all this stuff, you know. And just laid it on him till he was finished filming the movie. He was there for at least a month or so.
Wow.
So, yeah. And so he'd call me up. I'd go over and bring him records. I went over to his to this residence three times. And that's how it started. Now, I could go on and we could, like, talk about other stuff. If you want, I'll spend the whole thing giving you the whole story. But how about this? I'll just give you the punchline. We made friends. And he would end up dedicating Briefcase Full of Blues to me.
Wow.
And I'll give you a couple of things. The third time I went over, he had a stack of records sitting on the dining room table. And he said, what can I do for you? What do you mean? He goes, you, what can I do? What is it that you want for doing this? You've taught us, you know, you taught us or whatever. And I just, like, the same day, I got to go backwards. We'll get to that. He comes around to my left and he goes, what do you think of this? And he shows me his fist and it says Jake. And I just look at it and I don't know what to think. I don't know what it's about. He goes, look at my partner, you know, Dan Aykroyd, you know, I told you about him. You know, he mentioned it when I first met him. You know, you remind me of Dan.
Right.
You know, so I go, told you about him. Well, he's like my partner. And we're thinking of doing a skit on this variety show. He didn't go on Saturday Night Live. And by then I knew there was a variety show called Saturday Night Live and he was a part of it. So you got to remember, this isn't days. These are, like, you know, they're making the movie, I'm playing gigs, whatever, we hook up, we go like this. I saw him at a couple of parties over this time and stuff. They would come to the King Cole Room, which I should tell you that story before we go, you have to. So, you know, they'd come into the King Cole Room and I'm going over to his house and we got a Monday night gig there. Now they're doing their thing, filming, and he's in town. And I heard, just to tell you where my head's at, was that a guy named Doug Kinney was there. And that is the comedy writer for National Lampoon, which I had a subscription to. National Lampoon, the magazine, was hilarious. And Doug Kinney's a part of this. And that, well, you know, wow. That, you know. And I met him outside of his hotel room. He was staying, you know, just for a second, you know, like knocked on somebody. I was with someone and they knocked on and he came out. Moving on. So Belushi is like, what do you think of this? And I didn't know what to say. We're making a skit. And we're going to, I want to, you know, we're thinking of doing this thing called the Blues Brothers. And I'm going to be Jake. And Dan's going to be Elwood. And I remember that. That's about it. And I'm going, I don't know where this is going. And then it turns into, what can I do? You turning me. He didn't say, you turning me on to all this music. I don't even remember. But what can I do for you? What do you want? What can we do? And I said, give credit where credit's due. That is my, these are the people I love. People got to know more about this. And I didn't know he's going to make a movie, but he's going to be on TV and he's a movie actor. So I said, this guy's, you know, he's got, I'm not stupid. I'm not dumb enough to not think he doesn't have any, you know, some sort of public, you know, popularity, right?
Sure.
But I just said, give credit where credit's due. These people have got to know about these artists. I'm deeply into that. Still, I'm a Sideman fan. You know, I'm the fan of the people that make the stuff. And of course, the people that, you know, everybody's doing their part. But in music, man, you know, you got a person up there singing, and then you got the guys that play behind it, you know. Incredible. So I'm saying give credit where credit's due. Those are my records. Some of those are my sister's records. Some of those are my father's records. And I just want you to give credit. And he goes like this. Now, this is where it gets tricky. This is where it gets tricky. It's like thinking years later, you know, he'd never said, you know, Curtis, if you got yourself a lawyer, you could get creative consultant and probably get paid well. You know, and he said it to me a second time, which is another story, but he brought it up again. And I think, really, I'd like to think that he was feeling a little guilty about it because he didn't do it. And Judy Jacklin would bring it up to me. And Judy, his wife, kind of championed me because this is a long story, but and I'm not going to tell it. But there were points that got, you know, I mean, they blew up. You know, and but he didn't go, if you got a lawyer, you can create it. I just said, give credit where credit's due. And he did.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yeah, except let me say this.
He go ahead. Said,
give credit where credit's due. And they dedicated Briefcase Full of Blues to me. The record, the album is dedicated to Curtis. And I would find out through Dan Aykroyd in person that Curtis was named after you, played by Cab Calloway.
Wow.
Yeah.
One thing that I had heard, and I'm wondering if this is because of your conversation with Belushi, when you said give credit where credit is due, there was an article that I read about the Blues Brothers that they could have scored and made a lot of money off of the music that came from that show, but they chose to give credit to the writers and make sure that they got their pay. Do you think that was part of that, that message you gave him?
I don't know. What writers are they talking about? The writers of the songs? Because they get their pay.
Yes,
I turned them on to, look, you know, King Floyd, Hey There Sugar Dumpling, you know, Groove Me. I was doing that in the Nighthawks. I'm the one who gave him, then it sounds like I'm bragging. I'm the one who, don't take it that way. Sorry, folks.
No, no.
But look, here's more story. So the Nighthawks break up and I fall right in line. They broke up because they didn't want to go on the road. And I want a career. So man, I'm hooking up with these two brothers, man, because they want the same career. And they invited me. They said, you should just join us, you know. So now I'm in the Robert Cray Band. And what happened was, let's see, where was I going with this? A couple of things happened. They called us up at rehearsal. John did. And I'm rehearsing with Robert Cray. The telephone rings and either DK or DK picked it up and said, Curtis, it's Belushi. And I asked Belushi, how'd you get this number? And he said the same thing. He goes, I have my ways. Okay. So what's up? You know, and it goes, look, man, I'm here rehearsing with the band and we're going to do a skit and I want to say your name and I want to give, you know, and mention your name. And really, and now I know, and by this point, which is about a year later, is, you know, probably almost a year, but he goes, yeah, I want to give you and mention your name. And by this point, I know it's Saturday Night Live. I still haven't seen it. There's there's these little sections that still haven't seen the show yet. So I go, really? He goes, yeah. Well, I go, you know, I'm in the Robert Cray band right now. I mean, I'm no longer with the Nighthawks. And, you know, can you mention? He goes, it's not about Robert. It's about you. I want to say your name. And I go, well, I'm kind of makes it awkward, you know, something like that. And he goes, I'll see what I can do. That's what he said. Okay. So we move on and he goes, so there's this bit of business you do. And it's in this song called, I Don't Know. I go, you're doing, I Don't Know. He saw me do this a handful of times. I Don't Know is originally by, you're going to get the history if you like it or not, is originally by Crippled Clarence Lofton, a great Barrel House piano player. I'm a piano freak. And he is this, and so that morphed into Willie Maben. You ever heard of Willie Maben? Piano player, huge hit called I Don't Know on Chess Records. Right? And so, and then Buddy Guy and Junior Wells do it on that record produced by Eric Clapton. You know, and who else has done this song? There's somebody else out there. Oh, Freddie King did it. Anyway, so I do this song, but in the middle of the song, I put in a run of comedy, a comedy gag. And because the song goes like this, do you mind? How long is this?
Go ahead, man.
I go, the song goes like this. It goes, getting sick and tired of the way you do. Good kind papa gonna poison you. Sprinkle goofy dust all around your bed. You wake up one of these mornings, find your own self dead. She said you shouldn't say that. I said, I don't know. I don't know what my baby's putting down. You know that song, right? So in that kind of a break, I go, getting sick and tired of the way you do, good kind papa gonna poison. You know, she said you shouldn't say that. And I put in this part and he took it and he's calling me to get what it is that I would do. So you want that gag, hon? He goes, yeah. I go, okay. And so I go, she said you shouldn't say that. I said, baby, are you going to make like a camel and walk a mile or make like Chesterfield and satisfy? And the audience is, you know, and that's cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
And she says, well, it depends on what you're packing, regular or king size. And so then it goes to whiskeys. So I whipped out my Jim Beam, and it was as hard as a Canadian club. And I gave her a shot of cream at Kentucky, and that created the Wilkerson family. She said, I don't know. And then it goes into that. And that's what I would do. And Blucci goes, I can only use about half of that. And so, all right. So he's even taking stuff from the show I do. Now, I got to give credit where credit's due. That bit about, you know, you're going to make like camel walk a mile, make like chess. Those are all from famous black comedians. Like Moms Mabley. But for these two guys, it was Skillet and Leroy, who are hilarious. And this is straight ahead, black comic, vaudeville. They go way back. Their good friend is Red Fox. Red Fox would bring him on Stanford and Son. You know, those two guys. And remember, what's her name? Wanda, LaRonda. She is a flat out, I mean, we're talking about Chitlin Circuit comedians. And he brought them on television, you know, which is very generous and very nice and very, of course, you know, he's bringing in his folks. And so all of those people on Stanford and Son are from Black Apollo Theater comedians. And I have their comedy records and a bunch of other stuff, you know, like Rudy Ray Moore and Jimmy Lynch and all these stuff. Great records, man. They're raw and they're X-rated, but they are hilarious. And these folks are top comedians. Wow. So I gave that to Bellucci and he put it on the live record and he did it on Saturday Night Live. And you can go on Saturday Night Live and find it. If you wish, I'll send you the link.
I'd love to have it.
Yeah, yeah. It's the first time the Blues Brothers. So he goes, well, we're going to say your name, going back to the story. And so I gave him that bit of business. He goes, okay, so watch for your name. I don't watch Saturday Night Live because I'm working. I didn't say anything. I go, okay, go, but we're going to mention your name, blah, blah, blah. And so this is what happened. This whole thing with Bellucci it just turned many, many wonderful ways. And this is one of them. So we go to a club in Corvallis, Oregon. It's called Mother's Mattress Factory. And we're playing the Robert Cray Band. I come up to the bartender and say, can we play an extra long first set, second, and take a break? Because I guess I'm going to be mentioned on Saturday Night Live. And there's already sort of rumor out and stuff, but he has no problem. He goes, sure. So we play an extra long set or two. And then, because I think the show came on about 11 o'clock and it was a 2-hour show when it first started. And believe me, but it sounds like I knew all of this. I didn't know any of this shit. You know, it comes, you pay attention. So,
right.
We all sit around. It was one of those bars that has a sunken living room, and it had one of those giant screen televisions, but it was the kind that was a box with 3 or 4 different colored lights. You know, you kids out there, this was something. This was like, woo, science. And it would show television on whatever kind of butcher paper or film screen or whatever against the wall. We all sat around and Saturday Night Live came, and it is Paul Schaefer doing Don Kirshner. Do you know who Don Kirshner is?
Yes, sir.
And, you know, by the way, for you students out there, Don Kirshner was a producer, promoter, ran record companies and publisher of many songs that he took a piece of and da, 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 very wealthy. And he ran and did, what was the name of the show?
Don Kirshner's Rock Concert.
Don Kirshner's Rock Concert. And so Paul Schaefer is doing Don Kirshner, real stiff and real like. And they go, thanks to Curtis Salgado and the Cray Band, here are the Blues Brothers. And the Blues Brothers play. And then at the end of the night, the end of the show, they do one more song. And guess what it is? I don't know. And Bellucci doing the, you know, girl, I whipped out my Jim Beam and, you know, that whole thing. So, man, he gave credit where credit was due. But I'm watching my influence into the Blues Brothers. I'm not the only one. I'm not going to sit there and go, me, me, me. I'd be guilty. I'd feel guilty. But I was his muse, Bellucci's muse. It was Dan Aykroyd's idea. And Dan was trying to get, and this is what John told me in person. You know, Dan's been trying to get me into this and we're going to start this skit. That's what he said when he walked up and he showed me Jake. And, you know, remember Dan Aykroyd. And I would later on meet Dan Aykroyd. So, and it was in L.A., and where Bellucci had me fly in and hang out with him while he filmed the movie 1941. So it wasn't just a bump into it. It wasn't like, well, we'd come in and then all of a sudden I'm gone. The guy wanted me to hang out. We got along. He was genuinely interested in this music and the history. He was an actor and he's very intelligent. And he said, I'll fly you down. So he flew me down to LA and I hung out with him for 2 weeks down there.
Wow.
why he made the movie.
Listen, and, go ahead.
Well, that's to go back online. Is he, you know, he gave credit where credit's due. And
yes, sir.
Yes, you know, and we made friends. And I always thought I'd see him again. I am a recovering drug alcoholic addict. I've done it all. And I was killing myself. And I knew it. And I liked myself better than that. And I didn't like the people or what kind of people it drew or just the behavior of us, not them, but me as well. Like, Jesus, I OD'd a couple times and just, you know, that's it. I'm quitting. I quit. And my band members at the time and at a different, this is 1987, knocked on my door with, this is another story how I got clean, but I was told my liver was swollen. And the doctor says, you ever heard of AA? No. Says, well, I'm a member of it. And we're not supposed to be, and it's anonymity in a program. We don't. But if you ever need the help, and this is what happened. I was on stage and I scored my dope and I'm going to go shoot up coke. And, you know, I'm not proud of this, but this is, you know, and I'm doing this for a while, not for years, but it's just escalated into this. And I was walking out of the club and I looked over and there's the doctor who said, if you ever need help, let me know. I just turned around like a hand just went like a big God hand, turned around, spun me, walked me towards him. And I just came up to him and I literally grabbed him and I said, Steve, I need help. He goes, oh, really? I go, yeah. He goes, okay, so what do you say? I got a gig. Right then, the owner of the club comes up and goes, what are you guys talking about? And Steve goes, Curtis is talking about going into treatment. And I go, I am? I didn't, what? And so I got to finish this. So the club owner's got one of those mini stage lights. And he flips it on and goes, well, let's look at your eyes. And he starts, you know, and he shines this. And they both kind of chuckle over the tortureness of this and them torturing me. And then their smiles disappeared. I'm looking at them and they just went. And the owner goes, yeah, maybe you should do that. And he walks off. I went home to do my stash or what I had bought. And I looked into my eyes because I won't forget that. And I told that doctor, and I don't know where it's going to go. And they were bright yellow. So I had yellow jaundice. And I just went, wow. So anyway, I did my thing. I didn't sleep. End of the story is there's a knock on the door. And there's the doctor, Steve. And he's brought the keyboard player and the bass player. And they go, you want to get clean and sober? And I thought for about 30 seconds. And I go, yeah. And he goes, is this about Jesus? He goes, no. It's, do you believe in a higher power? Do you believe in a God? Well, something's going on that's bigger than us. Yeah. You know, that's what I'm thinking. And he goes, I go, is this about Christ? Are we going to go? He goes, no. You make a higher power, whatever you want to make. And I said, and I love this. I'm like crazy about piano players. I said, can I make it Thelonious Monk? He goes, sure. You can make your higher power, Thelonious Monk. I go, okay, then, good. You know, and that's, I could go so many different ways, you know, but that saved my life. Next thing I know, I got clean and sober. And within months, I had a record deal. I was just like, you know, and I tell you, it wasn't like, it made me just, I just wanted to get out there and kick ass, you know. And, you know, I've been, there's a lot of, half the stories you hear about me or come to me and tell you, and I'll go, yeah, I made a fool of mine. Yes, I'm an asshole. But basically, they're all blowing out of proportion. I can, the stuff that I've done is, you know, I'm not proud of it and stuff. Never ripped anybody off. But, you know, just to myself, my family, the people that love me and whatever, I'm so glad I'm clean and sober. Man, it's the best thing I ever did, you know.
Curtis, so, anyway. I could spend hours talking to you. We could talk.
I knew
about,
I'd run you
we,
down. I knew it.
No. You haven't run me down at all. I am fortunate and blessed to be able to talk to you and capture some of these stories. rather than go through more of the Robert Cray story and the Santana and all that, I want to flip the page because you've turned this towards health. And I wanted to talk to you about your diagnosis of liver cancer in 05. Mm-hmm. You underwent a successful liver transplant in 06. Now, my mother was also a transplant recipient just a year before your own. Wow. So I understand the weight of the experience from the family's perspective. But how has that event tempered your view of life and your music? And are you as big an advocate for organ donation as Walter Trout has become?
Oh, yeah. I'm the one that I helped Walter get his liver transplant.
You know,
Maria called me up and said, I'll get to that later. But yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yes. But, you know, people's spiritual aspect and stuff like that, you can see why they don't want to. Or, I mean, it's the idea how we bury ourselves or take care of our dead or this. It's like, it is, of course, as old as us itself. So organ donor and stuff is, look, it could be seen because our imagination and whatever, but life is raw, really. You know,
yes, sir.
You find that out when you watch your wife give birth, you know, hey, we're mammals. You know?
Three times.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Like
this whole miracle, but this whole thing is right down to like onto the wire. Would you agree? You know, so for me, here's what happened. Ask me the question again, but a little more. Because I got a lot.
I just wanted to ask you how the cancer scare that you went through when you had to have the transplant, how that tempered your view of life and your music.
I think you already know, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that says this. It changes your life. It seems like, so I'll start. Here's a quick story. So I'm clean and sober, and I've got years under my belt and stuff, but I got a gallstone attack. And, I was in Connecticut and doing a gig, and I had the worst pain on the side, just like ached. And it was, I knew what it was. It was gallstones. And I knew that I hadn't, but nothing had flared up yet. And I walked it out, sang it out. And then I went home, and a couple of months ago go by, and I go have breakfast. And I come home, and I start getting this attack again. And what it is, gallstones plug up. Your gallbladder is like an extra little liver or thing, right?
Like a filter,
and
yep.
It's a filter. And the stones are plugging up the connection between it and your liver or stomach, your stomach. And so, man, this really hurt. And I called up a girlfriend. And women play a major part in my life. So I call up a girlfriend who goes, I go, can I come over and just hang out at your house? Because I am in pain. I just want to chill. And not that I had, you know, I could chill at my house, but this is killing me. And this woman's very smart, very sweet. And plus she's got a large bed with a huge television screen. So I go over and she, you know, meanwhile, she sneaks around the corner and gets on the phone and calls up the doctor. This woman that I hooked up with, I'm not going to give names and stuff. She lives in Florida now, but she was smart. And she calls up the doctor because she's been helping me get hepatitis C, the cure for it. And I've gone through it and I didn't take it because the percentage of it killing hepatitis C was small. The doctor came and goes, you have hepatitis C, you should get rid of it. But you have moderate hepatitis C. And I go, what's moderate? What do you mean? He goes, I don't know. You tell me. I'll never forget that. And what do you mean? Is it big or small or half a liver? What is it? He goes, moderate it. But they got a cure, and you hit yourself up. You got to hit yourself up with a needle, and then it gives you the flu symptoms for most of the week, and then it wears off. But then you start again next week. So I'm sitting here going, I'm going to be on the road, and how long is the cure? Oh, it takes about a year. So it's like, I'm going to have the flu every day for a year? No, fuck that. I'm sorry. So I said no. Well, now when I get this gallstone attack, Tosh calls up, and she's been helping me get the new cocktail that's out. There's a new one out, and it's curing people 80%. And so it will kill me. I will get it. But here's what happened. She calls up the doctor and goes, get him into the emergency room now. Now. And so she comes back and sheepishly tells me, she goes, you called the doctor? Well, I can't afford a doctor. I had to, man. And I'm glad I did. He says, well, you need to go to the, I don't want to go to the emergency room. I said, I don't want to go. You know, I mean, I can't afford it. You know, money, there it goes, it's flying away. I go, just give me a bit, you know, see what happens. I try to go to sleep. I can't, it gets worse. And I go, hey, let's go, doctor. So I go to the doctor. I had to tell you that part. Sorry, I wasted your time. Anyway, I go to the doctor and they go, yeah, this thing's shot. Your gallbladder is shot. It's got to come out and you're going up to the emergency room. And I'm thinking, how in God's name am I going to afford this? I can't afford this. I don't have health insurance, which adds to the story. So I don't have health insurance. We have to, by law, we got to send you up there by law. So, and they're nice and stuff. So I go up there, you know, and they go, you don't have any platelets. That's what keeps you, your blood to clog. So they're super worried. If they open me up, I'm going to bleed all over hell's half acre.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm waiting there. And all I'm thinking about, well, day one in a hospital, you know, how much is that? How many thousands is that? Ridiculous. I don't have any health insurance. Day two, day three. And now they're like, well, and the doctor comes in, his name is Paul Hansen. And he kind of puts his hands on me and he goes, you have hepatitis? I go, yeah. How long do you think you've had it? I don't know. I mean, shit, I started needlework when I was about 13, you know, experimenting, acid, that kind of shit. Believe me, it was just a phase, a short little phase. And then he's checking in. He goes, I want to give you a biopsy. So, okay, I'm going to give you a biopsy. Why? He goes, well, just I'm going to have my cronies come in here and they'll do it. These two guys come in and they set me up and they give me a biopsy. Now, that was like Tuesday night. Wednesday, I'm still there. Thursday, nothing's happened. So I'm leaving. So I left. And those guys came back. His henchmen, they came back and said, you know, before they did the biopsy, they go, we got to check it out because we see something. We see a little spot. And I went, oh, okay. That would be the cancer. So then they give me the biopsy and then a full day passes and then Thursday comes and I split. Now I'm home at the same woman's house. The phone rings about 7 in the morning. She answers, it's for you. And it's Paul. And he says, Curtis, why'd you leave? Because nobody's doing anything. I can't afford this. It's like Thursday and I came in Monday and I'm supposed to get, what's going on? Well, they were waiting for the platelets to unfreeze, a bag of platelets. Whatever that is in a freezer and they're trying to wait till it thaws out so they can give it to me. This is some sort of, you know, I just said a cell or something that makes your blood clog. Anyway, moving on. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is you got to come back. Why? Because we missed the spot. And I said, why? Because he missed the spot. And he says, what spot? Your guy said there's a spot. That's why you guys are doing a biopsy. He goes, Curtis, you got a tumor 5.5 centimeters, and I think it's cancer. And I just said, I just screamed fuck as loud as I could. I end up on the floor cross-legged, which is where I am at now. And I just sat down on the floor. And, oh, Jesus. So here's to answer your question. I've got cancer, 5.5 centimeters, no health insurance. I watched my mother die of cancer. She had from smoking. And, you know, I always swore I'd never get cancer. And now here I am with it. The very thing, you know, the very thing that I cured myself of and got away from is killing me anyway. You know, what you do, kids, out there in the past or now in the future or now in present, is going to catch up with you. Believe me. You're drinking and you're drugging and you're whatever you're doing, all your ecstasy, and yeah, it's going to take effect. Anyway, moving on, I was just, what do? I'm dead. And so just got down and just started taking care of business. I called up my manager. I called up another friend of mine. My friend of mine goes, you know, he mentions this guy that I'm making a record with, and he's very wealthy. And he calls me up and says, Curtis, you know, I'm going to donate $100,000 towards your liver. And I mean, my shoulders were like, you know, they just kind of went, you know, kind of like that. They just, wow. That's it. And then I went to see Paul Hansen, and there's the tumor on the screen. And he goes, well, we could do this and that, but you don't have health insurance. And a lot of people that do transplants, they're not going to take you. And a lot of people that do transplants, there's 92 transplant centers across the United States. And they're not going to take you because, get this, 5.5 centimeters. That's 0.5 centimeters too big. Not 1 centimeter too big, 0.5 centimeters too big for you to get a liver transplant. Most of them are going to reject you. So I missed it by 0.5. What do I do? Now, all I'm doing is, I mean, you say how it changes your life. I'll run through this story or get to the punchline now. It's like, I was given 6 months to live. I said to the doctor, how long? So what do I do? He goes, well, I can't afford that. And then I said to him these key words, what would you do if you were me? And he was like, you know, and he did a quick flip in his head and went, you know, there's this program out there. I think that we could get you on, and it's called Bridge to Transplant. And we could get you onto them, not promising anything, but we could get, you know, because there's these little programs out there. We could get this up there and start the ball rolling and all of that. And I would do that. But it's really not going to cure cancer. What this is a particular radiation treatment that's going to shrink the tumor and give you more time. And so I'm going, okay. And I go, how long do, and we're talking, my manager leaves, the girlfriend, she leaves. It's just me and Paul. And Paul, he stands up, he's got other patients, and he starts walking down the long hallway. And I'm looking at him and I go, hey, Paul. And I'm looking at the screen, and it's things about this big, you know, and I go, and before I finish the sentence, he goes, how long do you have to live? I go, yeah. He goes, well, in other words, how long do you have to live? It's how long until that thing metastasizes. So I got a bomb, a hand grenade that's going to burst. And when it does, I'm gone. And so how long? About 6 months. And I go, 6 months? And he goes, that's an eye opener, isn't it? And then turn the corner.
Wow.
Right. So it's just like, hang on for life. And I just went ahead, and everybody and their dog helped me out. So much love came my way. That's part of what cured it. And so many people, all of Portland, the blues situation, the people did concerts all over America. Bonnie Raitt paid for my rent. I had some other points to do with this, but Bonnie Raitt Pacer, my manager put together with another friend named Lowell and Lowell McGregor and Shane Tappendorf put together this benefit. Taj Mahal, Robert Cray, Steve Miller. So wow. Steve Miller, big name, Taj Mahal, Robert Cray, Everclear, who had a top 10 hit. They were like number three in the charts, and they're from Portland. And then Rick Astron and the Nightcats, or Charlie, Little Charlie and the Nightcats, right? And Taj Mahal with the Phantom Blues Band. And that's how I hooked up with them, right? And they all played for free. And we did it in the Coliseum here in Portland, who donated the Coliseum to me. And then the newspaper, the Oregonian, gave me two full page spreads to advertise the festival. Two wow. of them. And they paced them apart a few, you know, weeks apart. You know how much a full page spread is in a major.
A lot of money.
Yeah, it's 10 grand or something. And then volunteers, hundreds at the Coliseum. They cut it in half. It wasn't like, you know, a Coliseum, but they cut the Coliseum in half here. And I can't remember what kind of stage they have a name for it, but they cut it in half. First 10 rows were like $250 a piece tickets, blah, blah. But Judy Jacklin, John Belushi's wife, flew in to be an MC and a host of the ceremonies and to talk and stuff. It was just like, so much love poured my way. It broke me down. Like I broke down. And you, what do you do? How do you pay back? And everybody's, Curtis, just keep paying your music. It's the same, man. You know, I know. And so what it is and how it changed is it's hard to describe. You don't forget it. But on a other sort of, what's the term for this? I can't think of the term. I wish I could. But it's kind of like everything's meaningless. All the shit that's going on, the internet, the politics, the president, the dictators, this, the terrorists, this, all the bad, the good, this, television, media, this, it's all meaningless. The meaning of life is that it ends. And we find these like, and then it goes on. It's just like, and there you go, you know. And we think of our friends and they cross our heads, or you think of a star, a great movie, a great this, a tragic, a this and this and this. And it's just like, we're in this moment and you're going through and I've already lived this way anyway, but it's like one day at a time. And God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. Because if you step wrong one way, you're going to make a fool out of yourself, you know. And, you know, I just went program on you, but I don't know where that, whoever wrote that, but that's pretty much it in a nutshell. And it's really, I mean, it's just like, why do the wealthy want so much more? They're addicted. Why did this and why they, there's enough billionaires out there to actually set America and for the money they owe China. Now that's pretty stupid of me to say, and I realize that, but there's just so much out there. And I don't know, man, it's just, humanity's inhumanity to humanity. It's just remarkable. I don't think we're up for it. So try to be the best person you can. Try to like love somebody. Try to keep yourself so, you know, try not to get angry. Try and turn the other cheek, all that stuff. You know, I do believe in that stuff, but it really is. It's just like, you know, it is about, I want to go with respect and respect other people and just try and help as much as you can. and be a good person. So people go, you know, yeah, he was an asshole, but he sure can sing. I want a little more than that. You know, just be nice to everybody. It's just a waste of time. Jesus.
Yeah.
I want the moment, you know. I want the moment to, God, I can't believe, everything's a miracle. Every single thing is a miracle. Everything's vibrating. Everything's, you know, it's, you know, everything is in and then everything dissolves and then it comes back together. And, you know, that's what the universe is. We're made out of the universe. You know, ever think of that, you know, there's a trillion galaxies. The Earth is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour and we're not falling off. It's like, that's insane. This is insane. And it's getting, and then we get caught up in anxiety and what's going on. It's just like, oh my God. But it's a hell of a ride, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Just try and treat each other with respect and love and have empathy. Listen. See if you can have empathy and put yourself into, I'm a very big on that. You know, see the other side. At the same time, I should go to anger issue class, you know, and you know, I got a temper, but it's on me for having a temper. It's just like, I get pissed off, like, fuck. Okay. And usually what does it is my phone or the internet. Yeah.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Curtis Salgado. I appreciate you so much. You had the distinction of being the longest interview I've done to date.
Oh, well, you can edit all you want.
No.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate everything that you've given me today.
All right.
I have one final question for you, mm-hmm. and then we're going to wrap this up.
All right.
It looks like your tour calendar is going to get pretty busy this summer, at least at the start here. Looks like you got a stop in Norway, followed by a busy Central and Eastern U.S. series, including stops in Chicagoland, New York, and Vancouver.
Yes, sir.
Where can folks go to get more information on you, buy some merchandise, some CDs, or book you for a gig?
First of all, go to Intrepid Artists to book a gig here in the United States, Intrepid Artists. Secondly, go to CurtisSalgado.com. We're trying to make it better. And I'm about to reskin it. I'm about to re-rag, rinse off, and, you know, I rinse off, re-rag. So I'm not a big social guy, you know, on the social media, you know, but that's where you can do it. And they'll be putting up my tour. Like you've already said where I'm going. So where are you getting it? And then tell
me.
Got
it off your website. Yep.
Yeah. So that's the answer, off the website.
Awesome.
And I've been working on, and then I'll end this up. I got a guy that does social media for me. And I pay him, and we're close friends, but I don't want to, so I pay him, and he's good at it. And I'm always advertising on my social media, which is Facebook, or we're trying to, Instagram or whatever it is. I have no idea what he's doing. I just make stupid little videos, and I'm not as bad as some, and I should get more, but it's just not me, you know. See, I'm pretty easy to find, you know.
Yes, sir.
I got a live record coming out here. Just started working on it, recorded live in Seattle 2-3 weeks ago. Did my old songs that I haven't done on stage in years. Some I've never done. And did 2 shows in one night. And putting together a live CD. Radio won't pick it up, but it's just something to give like me live. And it's going to crush. I think it's going to crush. And I'm always writing songs. So more material, write songs, more content. But I just play music. I'm just trying to get better. I'm taking singing lessons. I hook up with harmonica players. What else is there to do? You know?
Right, right.
Get better at my craft and go forward.
Well, Curtis Salgado, my deepest appreciation for you joining me today on Time Signatures. Safe travels to you, sir. And anytime you have something to promote, including that new album, my door is wide open to you. All you need to do is give me a call. And you're
No, really?
That's simple. All the best to you, my friend.
Hey, I'm sorry. I have a tendency to override and whatever, but you get me going, I'll tell you.
No, this is good stuff. This is good stuff. Well, as this episode comes to a close, I want to tell you briefly about the VFW National Home, located just about 30 miles southwest of my current location in Eaton Rapids, Michigan. The VFW National Home assists military, veterans, and their families with children by creating a foundation of services and resources to achieve their personal and family goals in order to move forward in a positive, safe, and healthy environment. Among the many things offered through the VFW National Home are single-family homes within the community at no cost, tutoring, classes, secondary financial assistance, and educational resources to empower and grow. And they also offer licensed daycare for their residents at no charge. Visit VFWNationalHome.org today, or to learn more, you can also make a tax-deductible donation to the home. And thank you for your consideration. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my eternal thanks to Curtis Salgado, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, is my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.